Slamcast time.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Clandestine Time. I am your host Tom Secker, coming to you from the grassy knolls of North Yorkshire, and this is episode 33, True Lies and Real Bad Arabs.
This is like out of an action movie, but this is real. This is real.
We are at war with Iraq. Wasn't that easier? Because for more than a century we had been vilifying all things Arab. Think of Arabs, what do we see? What images come to mind? Arabs are the most maligned group in the history of Hollywood. They're portrayed basically as subhumans. We feel that Arabs are not like us, or not like anyone else, then let's kill them all. Then they deserve to die, right?
Waste the mother!
See the Arab humanity. What's left?
Today we welcome back Pierce Redmond, a frequent guest on the show, to discuss the portrayal of Arabs in Hollywood. We talk about the documentary Real Bad Arabs, which details much of the stereotyping of Arabs in popular movies, and also the film True Lies is an example of these trends. We look at some of the limits in the analysis offered by Real Bad Arabs, the military involvement in the making of True Lies, and the careers of the actors who played the two main Arab characters in the film, Art Malik, who seems to specialise in playing terrorists, and Grant Heslov, who won an Oscar for producing Argo. So hello again, Pierce. Welcome back to Clandestine, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great, and it's so glad to be back on Clandestine. We haven't spoken for a little while, and I always enjoy coming on your show, and we always have really great conversations.
We do, and I've invited you back because one of the listeners to the show suggested doing an episode on True Lies, and it made me think, when I was reflecting on their email about this, it made me think about the documentary Real Bad Arabs, which is all about how Arabs are portrayed in Hollywood movies. And I thought, rather than just do a show on True Lies, we could do a show on both of these, both the sort of the example in True Lies, but also the documentary that discusses the broader implications of this. And given that your whole focus is on this kind of imperial post-colonial policies and the propaganda around that, I thought you'd be the ideal guy to have on to chat to about this. And I always enjoy talking to you, so, you know, any excuse. But yeah, so Real Bad Arabs, let's start with that, because it's better to do the overall rather than the example first. This is a 2006 documentary that I saw a few years ago, can't remember when, and it's based on the book of the same name by Jack Shaheen. I've never read this book, but I do know there was this award-winning short film called Planet of the Arabs, which is really quite funny and quite entertaining, also based on the book. So I'll link up all of this in the source notes, and I do recommend both the short film and the documentary. But you watched this quite recently, Real Bad Arabs, so what were your overall impressions of it?
I was actually really blown away by the film. You know, going into it, you sort of assume, yeah, I know that, you know, Arabs are portrayed horribly in Hollywood, but Professor Shaheen really kind of breaks that apart and gets into more of the complexities of it. And he focuses on the whole sort of, you know, from the very beginning of Hollywood and this concept of what he calls Arab land, you know, which is always the desert. And there's always the, you know, the harem, and there's always this kind of barbaric Arab who kidnaps a white girl and sort of expands upon that throughout, and you see that as, you know, Hollywood films progressed over time, these same memes are injected over and over and over again. And also a really interesting part is that, excuse me, he doesn't just focus on the sort of obvious action movies where Arabs are all terrorists. He also puts a little bit of the spotlight on movies that you would never even expect to have negative portrayals of Arabs. And it begins, you begin to start thinking, you know, why the hell is some of the movies he mentions, like Father of the Bride 2 or Back to the Future, or a really interesting one is Neil Simon's Chapter 2, which has a sort of throwaway line at the beginning talking about London, and his character's brother asks him, oh, how was London? And he says, full of Arabs. And it's sort of like, what? You know, I mean, why even mention this? He goes on and talks about the just, you know, focusing just on the Palestinian aspect and how, you know, Palestinians sort of get an even worse rap than all other Arabs. You know, Arabs are sort of this nameless, faceless person in these movies. The Palestinians get an even, you know, more sort of horrible portrayal. So I really enjoyed the film a lot, and it actually made me, you know, look at things like True Lies a little bit more and look at the whole, you know, military involvement in these films in a deeper way than I thought.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does do that, I feel. I think what I particularly liked about this is that they weren't just focused, like you say, in a sort of, yeah, they aren't just focused in a sort of one-dimensional way on the portrayal of Arabs as terrorists, which is certainly what I would and have come to expect from Hollywood movies. I don't think there's many people who wouldn't have spotted that, who actually, you know, pay attention to entertainment. But they really did draw it out in quite a three-dimensional way, in that they're always, I mean, the list I've got here is that Arabs are always pretty much portrayed as dangerous, as backwards, as terroristic, incompetent, sex-obsessed, sort of oil-soaked, if you like, and stupidly wealthy. Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's it.
And that's pretty much what they show in this documentary, is that this is a portrayal over and over again. It doesn't matter what sort of film it is. It doesn't matter what the character is. These are the broad themes that they have to fit into at least some of these. Otherwise, it seems like the character doesn't tend to get into the film. It seems like you can only do it if you hit at least, you know, two or three of these particular characteristics. So, I mean, did any of the films that were discussed in the documentary really stand out for you as ones that you either have or haven't seen and that you really wanted to draw people's attention to? Because there's a lot of films in there, but so, you know, which ones would you pick out?
I would say that The two I mentioned earlier, Father of the Bride 2 and Back to the Future, are really interesting because, I mean, ostensibly these movies have absolutely nothing to do with Arabs. The original Father of the Bride movie, you know, there's no mention of Arabs. And Back to the Future, I mean, I sort of even forgot that was a thing, that in the beginning of the movie, these Libyan terrorists gunned down Christopher Lloyd's character, and that's what forces Michael J. Fox to, you know, go back to the future so that he can alter the present. So these are really bizarre because these injections of these negative portrayals of Arabs in comedy movies, I think, you know, while comedy can be used to kind of make light of a situation or make a horrible situation sort of more palatable, it is also a really great way to normalize, you know, prejudice and racism towards a particular group. Because you're laughing at them and not, you know, in a good way. So I think both of those movies are interesting. And again, you have to just wonder, what was the reasoning behind having, you know, the Libyan terrorists in Back to the Future? You know, who sitting writing the script or the producers were like, yeah, let's include this. This is a good idea. So those are both really interesting. And the other one, which Professor Shaheen mentions, is Network, and that is a great film, and also loves the film as well. And people, if you're not familiar with the film, you'll be familiar with the sort of pop culture aspect of it, and that's the whole "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore," and that's a line that Howard Beale, the main character in the film, says when he goes on this sort of epic rant about everything that he, you know, is wrong. And I actually forgot, until I was watching Real Bad Arabs, that whole line revolves around this concept which made a big appearance in the 1970s in films about how Arabs, and particularly the Saudis, were buying up America, and they were going to control America through their oil money. So that's really interesting, because a lot of people, I think, watch Network and view it as a great commentary on media and particularly television, but they sort of forget that it's, you know, this anti-hero, Howard Beale, is a bit of a racist.
Or at least he's very much blaming this whole situation,
yes,
on quite a specific group of people, rather than taking... Mm. I mean, he, like you say, it's this epic rant that draws and hits on all kinds of things, and on which he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
But the sum total of this is, and who do we blame? And
right.
And his answer is the Arabs, and then a bit later on it's the Chinese, I think.
Yeah.
And so there's no sense of, you know, we can do anything about this. There's no sense of we can take some responsibility for this ourselves and empower ourselves by doing something about this bad situation. It is all just, you know things are bad and this is who to blame. And so, I mean, maybe Network is one of those that we should touch on in another episode of this podcast. But, I mean, going back to Real Bad Arabs, there were, I suppose, quite a lot of films in there that have explicit Department of Defense connections and collaboration in their production. And that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who's been listening to this podcast for any time, or, I suppose, really been paying any attention. I would also want to point out, he does hit on a few Disney films, and Walt,
yes,
Disney was a big friend of J. Edgar Hoover, and was therefore, you know, connected to the establishment in that way. So, I mean, is this what we're seeing here? Is this some kind of government-sanctioned prejudice? Because a lot of the time, the entertainment industry, particularly the modern entertainment industry, is quite PC, if you like.
Mm.
And that the prevailing tone that a lot of people perceive, rightly or wrongly, is towards those sorts of standards. And yet when it comes to Arabs, it seems you're allowed to be as racist as you like. So there is, you know what I mean? There is a certain tension,
oh, yeah,
there. They couldn't get away with this with any number of other groups. I mean, could you imagine even Chinese people being portrayed in the way that they portray Arabs? No, I mean, part of that is, I suppose, for profit reasons. China is a bigger cinema audience than I mean, are there very many cinemas in Muslim countries? It doesn't strike me as something that they'd be particularly into. So there is that going for it. But like I say, do you think this is some kind of state-sanctioned thing?
I think absolutely. And Professor Shaheen even picks up on this. And he quotes from Jack Valenti, who was the head of the Motion Picture Association, and had very deep connections in Washington. And Jack Valenti is famous for quoting, for saying that Washington and Hollywood spring from the same DNA. So, I mean, you know, I don't think you need much more than that. But yeah, I think that this is a definite sort of, you know, the Hollywood is kind of getting the okay from the government in some way to portray Arabs as all terrorists or as all, you know, lecherous, money-grubbing oil sheikhs. I think that's totally okay. And, you know, obviously, most, if not, you know, all of our major conflicts around the world deal either in the Arab world or in Muslim countries. And I think that, you know, Hollywood is a great propaganda tool and has been forever, basically. So, you know, this connection between the two of them, and the fact that all, for the most part, as Shaheen points out, almost all films depicting Arabs depict them in the several ways that you laid out before. So I think it's very clear that this is, some sort of agreement. I think you'd be kind of naive to think it wasn't, especially when you look at how many of these films have direct sponsorship from the U.S. government. So, you know, again, the U.S. government may not get behind a movie that portrays Chinese people or black people or Mexicans as really racist, but they're certainly willing to get behind any movie where, you know, the Arab characters are sort of nameless, wide-eyed fanatics who want to, you know, slap women around and you know, murder children. So I think, yeah, it's very, very clear. And a movie that Shaheen points out, which I haven't seen, Rules of Engagement, is, I mean, it was written by James Webb, who was a senator until very recently in Virginia and was a former Secretary of the Navy, was a big Reagan official, served in Vietnam. And that movie is, I mean, just like complete, utter fantasy. And is just insane. I mean, it's like some sort of neocon's wet dream come true, basically.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen Rules of Engagement either, but from the kind of summary that they give in the in Real Bad Arabs, in this documentary, it does sound like one of those. I mean, this isn't even based on a real incident, is it?
No,
this is just something they fabricated, this sort of some kind of riot at an embassy that results in the Marines or the soldiers or whoever they are just opening fire on this crowd and slaughtering dozens and dozens of people. So this didn't, you know, this didn't actually happen. It's not even like, well, I suppose we could use the example of Captain Phillips, but that takes a real event and twists it so radically that it may as well not be a real event. And yeah, Rules of Engagement, also on the DOD film list. So this is very much an establishment movie. And when you look at something like that, you got to be absolutely certain this is something that has been dreamt up by the political establishment. This isn't something that's just sort of come out of nowhere and got, official cooperation. This is something that seems to be through and through just political propaganda. But moving on a little bit, or stepping sideways, did you have any criticisms of this documentary? Because there were a few things in it that I was not entirely comfortable and happy with, but I'm just wondering if you had any.
I guess little things, nothing too... I'd be interested to see what you thought. I mean, some of the criticisms, I think, were just certain movies that were left out that I thought were really important that I was surprised he didn't pick up on. At the end of the movie, when he talks about positive portrayals of Arabs, and some of those movies are really interesting. Some of them I've seen, some I haven't, but look very interesting. But he does pick up on Syriana as some sort of positive portrayal, and I found to be a little ridiculous. Aside from, you know, CFR George Clooney being involved in the movie, Bob Baer served as the technical advisor on the movie, and he's a former CIA officer, and that's who the Clooney character is based on. And Bob Baer, I mean, is kind of one of these pseudo whistleblower CIA guys who is constantly, you know, carted out for the mainstream media and sort of will say things that sound a little bit controversial, but they're not really. And, you know, he makes this big point about, oh, I don't work for the CIA anymore. You know, the second you leave the agency, that's it. It's over. And I just don't believe that. And Bob Baer also has some pretty ridiculous theories that Iran is responsible for everything from, you know, 9/11 to the creation of Al-Qaeda and whatnot. So I was a little surprised that Professor Shaheen pointed to Syriana as a movie. And also, as I guess in Syriana, just to stick with that for a second, what could be perceived as, you know, positive, the end of the movie is basically a sort of reinforcement that the CIA is great and really necessary, because ultimately this like oil tanker is bombed in the Gulf because, you know, the CIA wouldn't let George Clooney do what he had to do to stop them. So in a lot of ways, it is a, you know, kind of reinforcement that, yeah, they might do some weird and horrible things, but they are necessary. We do need them because these terrorists are everywhere. And of course, you know, the movie never picks up on any of the connections between the CIA and these terror groups. So that was interesting. But I'd be interested to see what you didn't like.
Well, just to pick up on Syriana, I haven't actually seen that film yet. I have downloaded it recently because this rewatching the documentary reminded me. Yes, I did mean to watch that one. But from my kind of skimming of it, it comes across a lot like Homeland.
Yes.
It's one of those, it's, if you like, limited hangout television. You know, it portrays the CIA as doing some somewhat dodgy and corrupt things and maybe tolerating some stuff that they shouldn't really tolerate. But ultimately, the message is it's a hostile, dangerous world, and we need the CIA. We need agencies like this. I suppose my criticisms, the first one is that in his commentary, Shaheen treats 9/11 as though it was an attack by Arab Muslims. And I think if you're going to go down the path of looking at a lot of these films as political propaganda, it struck me as a little bit intellectually dishonest to just skim over that. I mean, I understand why a lot of people don't want to touch that topic, but it still infuriates me a bit when you don't yeah. know what I mean. It's not that I'm dismissing the guy. I'm just saying that was something I wasn't happy about. There is also, I mean, this whole discussion is basically what you might call post-colonial theory. It's about how do imperialist, colonialist nations behave when they can't just send an army into everywhere and just suppress the local population on a permanent basis, like they would have in the 18th, 17th, 19th century. Whereas nowadays, it's slightly more, I suppose the propaganda has to be slightly more subtle. It's not, because people may have actually, you know, met Arabs in their life, they do have to do something a little bit more clever than maybe they used to. But in this documentary, they focus exclusively on the effect that this has on the US audience, or at least the Western audience. And I thought one of their major oversights was, what's the effect of this on the Arab audience? What's the effect of this on people watching this, and these are the only characters that they can have any, you know, racial or ethnic identity with? Those are the, you know, people that they would naturally identify with. So what's the effect on them? Because you know what I mean? Once you label people a certain way, there is a certain number of people who will just go, fuck it, I might as well behave like that. Not that I'm in any way alleviating their responsibility for behaving badly. I'm just saying it probably does have this effect on people, would you say?
Oh, yeah. And I was actually surprised that they didn't focus at all on, you know, Arab or you know, quote unquote Muslim cinema, because it does exist. And, you know, obviously Iran is not a Arab country, but I mean, they have a vibrant, vibrant film industry, you know, and that runs the gamut of, you know, sort of, you know, what you would say more sort of traditional style movies to, I mean, you know, some of Kiarostami's movies get pretty out there, or Maklabov, who is banned from Iran. They make really interesting movies that are very different and portray lots of complexities. And the same is true in different Arab countries. In Morocco, there's a fairly vibrant film industry as well. So I was surprised that they didn't focus on that at all, just because, you know, yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of these movies make it over there and they do watch them. But I think, you know, they also have their own films. And I think that when you start watching a lot of these movies, especially Iranian movies, you start to get a really different idea about this group. It's no longer this monolithic country. And I think that's a great way to kind of break down a lot of these barriers that have been set up in your mind. So, I was a little disappointed they didn't, you know, touch on that at all. Obviously, this is like a short documentary. And, you know, I think they really wanted to hit on a couple really specific things. And I'm sure this is really targeted at a U.S. audience, to, you know, or a Western audience. So I think that's why they went there. But yeah, I was a little disappointed with that as well.
Yeah, and I just felt also that there was, I suppose my other criticism is that this is kind of my problem with a lot of this sort of leftist critique of popular culture, is that they're absolutely right to identify that these are racist stereotypes and that they are very reductive, and that's pretty damaging and a bad thing to be going on. But at the same time, there seemed to be nothing in this dialogue that actually helped to empower these people or encourage them to be any different to this. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, even the film itself made the mistake of doing what these propaganda Hollywood movies do overtly and intentionally. And I think it was a mistake in the documentary. I think this is just something they didn't really think about and kind of overlooked. But when your only choices are between the kind of, if you like, the rightist or at least establishment dialogue, where you're just some kind of demonic, incompetent, stupid, dangerous figure, and then you've got the leftist or progressive dialogue saying, oh, you're victims of oppression. It's like, well, where do you go with that? Neither of those is an empowering image for people. Neither of those actually encourages people to be more than their Hollywood portrayal. So, yeah, that was another one of my frustrations. And that's sort of one of my frustrations I have with a lot of this kind of dialogue. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think he says at the end of the movie that he's optimistic and whatnot, and that is great. But yeah, I mean, a little bit more would have helped. And I think that this kind of like culture on the left of like victimization is sort of negative. And it's great to point out these sort of things, but just being like, I'm a victim. Look at me. I mean, it's like, okay, great. But how are you going to actually, make real change? That's a little unfortunate as well. And that's definitely something you see over and over again, especially here.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a perhaps not so bad example of it. I'm not making that as a major criticism of this documentary. And I do think people really should go and watch it because it's one of the better documentaries about this sort of subject. It really is. And before we move on to True Lies, there was a little something from Alex Jones that I wanted to flag up for people. And this is this somewhat notorious claim now, when he said that the Arabs run Hollywood, or that the Arabs own Hollywood, which, given the portrayal of Arabs in Hollywood movies, is on its face completely absurd. No one would take over film companies and then allow those film companies to portray them in the most sort of negative racist way possible, would they? So this is kind of a really silly statement, and I will put up a link to when he tried to sort of retract this and backtrack from it, which is also rather amusing, because people say silly things, and what the best answer is to just hold your hands up and say, look, it was live radio, I said something silly.
Right.
Then everyone forgets about it. It doesn't matter anymore. But some people can't do that, it seems. How do we interpret this? Is this could we see Alex Jones as being affected by this propaganda? I mean, this is quite a common attitude. The sorts of attitudes that we see in these Hollywood movies, then they are taken on by the public, at least to some extent. And Alex Jones isn't immune to that, nor is anyone else, are they?
No, I think that. The pointing this out from Alex Jones is really important because, especially in the alt media, we talk a lot about, mind control and propaganda, but it's not always so. Mind control doesn't necessarily have to mean, programmed killers with trigger words that make them go on a rampage. Like, this is mind control. This is real mind control when you have these films that are just everywhere, and they slowly seep into your subconscious to the point when, you can have Alex Jones coming on and saying something that's just so just blatantly false, but saying it and kind of meaning, if you listen to the clip, he's pretty serious and,
He sounds serious at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No. And he's, talking about his sources, quote unquote, or whatnot. I think that really goes to show you the true power of mind control, the way that it can function on a mass scale. You don't need to force LSD down people's throats to control their minds. You can do it through films, through popular culture, and that's the easiest way, I think, to really do it. And that kind of shows that even Alex Jones is not immune to this. This happened, and I'll say even for myself, I don't think I'm immune to this entirely, because I didn't even really network. I didn't even think about that. There's some other movies that are mentioned in here that you don't even really think about, or you remember kind of laughing at when you were a kid, and then you watch Real Bad Arabs and you're like, oof, gosh, I can't believe I ever thought that. So yeah, I think that it's funny, but it's also very, it's a serious thing as well. And it can happen to anybody, If it can happen to Alex Jones, I mean, God.
Sure. Just before we move on to True Lies, final point on that. There is, of course, an element there of, I suppose, Alex Jones aping the character of Howard Beale, in that Alex Jones talks about all the same things that Howard Beale talks about. And his whole show, obviously, is, to some extent, an impersonation of that character. I don't think revealing any trade secrets in pointing that out. So it isn't all that surprising to see occasionally he does dip into that kind of thing, and he does throw out the odd thing where you just sort of, you listen to that again, you think, maybe not, Alex. Maybe you really have just said something that's complete bullshit there.
Yeah.
But anyway, enough kicking Alex Jones, because much as I enjoy it, it's not the sole purpose of this show. So True Lies, this is a, I suppose, quite an entertaining film in its way, but anyway, it's a It's a 1994 action comedy, and it was written, produced, and directed by James Cameron. Stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis, and there are some notable supporting roles in this film, some of which we'll get to a bit later on, but I would like to highlight Bill Paxton as the kind of pervy used car salesman. I did find his character to be genuinely quite amusing. And also Charlton Heston, who is sat wearing an eye patch. He's like the head of this intelligence organization. And anyway, there's a couple of others that we'll get into in a second. I imagine most people listening have seen this film. It was a very big, very popular film. But just a recap, the basic plot is that Arnold Schwarzenegger plays the world's least convincing spy, working for an organization that's basically the CIA, but it isn't called the CIA. And his family, who initially have no idea that he's a spy, progressively gets sort of more and more caught up in his action and intrigue-filled life, to the extent that the twin goals in the movie for Arnold Schwarzenegger of both saving his family and also stopping the evil Arab terrorists become one and the same goal. They become his trajectory, his whole purpose as a character just becomes the same thing. Would you say that's a fair summary of the movie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And thrown in is a extremely long section of the movie between, you know, him and his wife kind of rekindling their love life.
Yeah.
Which is weird. I remember the first time I saw this, I was sort of like, okay, so I guess the terrorists are gone. they don't really seem to be that important. And it just sort of turns into this very bizarre, he kidnaps his wife basically when she's with Bill Paxton, and they go through this whole thing ending up with Jamie Lee Curtis basically stripping for him in a hotel room. So a little odd and interesting that so much of the movie is that, and then it gets right back into the action.
Yeah, that is a strange detour that seems somewhat kind of crowbarred into the film, you might say, because it's otherwise a relatively straightforward, silly action movie, really. And the narrative is quite predictable and quite unoriginal, and I don't see that much point in us breaking that down in detail. And like I say, I'm sure most people have already seen the film anyway. But there are a few memes and details and characters and things that we wanted to draw out here. So, I mean, I'll go first, because there were a few that were pointed out by the listener who suggested doing this film, and they're all worthy of attention. The first one is the jet plane crashing into the skyscraper. You remember the Harrier jet at the end of the film? Kind of crashes into the glass of the skyscraper, and it all explodes like that. There is the wild, radical Islamic terrorist leader, which is a recurring figure, but it's particularly interesting to see the way it worked in this film, but we'll get into that in a little bit of detail. They also pointed out that the whole story is these layers of lies and deception that swirl around the protagonist, really. In everyone's lying to everyone in this film. It isn't a film in which honesty is in any way rewarded. But they said most of all what stuck in their mind was that at the climax to the film, when the terrorists have taken over this big building, one of the spies sneaks in and actually uses a video camera as an assassination weapon. Mm. They have a gun hidden in the video camera. And this is much like the Massoud story. You remember Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Afghan resistance leader. So there's a lot of different stuff kind of going on in this film that is, I think, worthy of people's attention. Is there any of those that you'd particularly want to draw out?
I think obviously the portrayal of the main terrorist is extremely interesting. We'll get into more of that. But I wasn't even thinking about the Massoud thing and the gun. That is really just bizarre, weird one. And one that one thing that I kind of thought about after watching Real Bad Arabs and then going back and watching True Lies and kind of, using some of the criteria that Professor Shaheen talks about, I found really interesting that Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of embodies a lot of these evil Arab man traits. So he's super possessive of his wife. You know, he believes that she's cheating on him. Even though, he doesn't really pay any attention to her, he's completely, you know, just sort of a zombie whenever he comes home. But yet he kind of treats her like, you know, she's his property. Then he goes, you know, through this series of events where he completely humiliates her, from kidnapping her when she meets with this guy she might have an affair with, to making her strip for him. And then, you know, in that scene, he goes and kisses her, and it's really creepy. You know, it's sort of like, is that how you rekindle your love life, Arnold, by, you know, making your wife think that she's working for some spy agency and then having her strip for someone who she doesn't know, and then he kisses her and she attacks him? And it's sort of like, yeah, I would do the same thing too. You know, it's pretty disgusting. And the other thing is that it seems that the way that they're able to rekindle their sex life is through the brutal murder of all of these Arabs. You know, when they're in the, they go to the Florida Keys at one point where they're going to detonate this missile. And, you know, while Arnold is, you know, mowing down different Arab terrorists, he kisses Jamie Lee Curtis. And ultimately the movie ends with the two of them becoming spies and going around, you know, murdering Arabs everywhere. And that's, you know, kind of how their marriage stays afloat, which is a really interesting, and again, one of these sort of subtle things that are injected into your psyche, that I definitely did not really pick up on any of that the, you know, first time I saw this movie. I thought it was, you know, just the greatest thing ever. the you know, graphic violence to Jamie Lee Curtis naked, you know, I was like, oh my God, yeah, this is like an awesome movie.
No, well, it is like a Michael Bay movie. It does appeal to the sort of 12-year-old boy in you.
Mm. And is in Miami, too, just like all Michael Bay movies.
Well, and in fact, if you watch the making-of documentary or little featurette about True Lies, where they talk about the sort of DOD involvement in the film and some other stuff, James Cameron at that point actually looks an awful lot like Michael Bay looks now.
Yes, he does.
It's curious how similar those men are. Anyway... yeah, I think you're absolutely right to draw that out. And this was the thing that I suppose disturbed me more than anything else in the film, is this degree of deception and lies just going on throughout the whole film, pretty much. It's only when Schwarzenegger actually gets injected with a truth serum that his wife gets any truth out of him at all. The rest of the time, he just lies to her continuously, and to the extent, like you say, of kidnapping her and making her feel that she's got to be a stripper for an intelligence agency. I mean, really? That's how you treat your wife?
Yeah.
No surprise, of course, that James Cameron has had several marriages. None of them have lasted very long. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the purpose of this movie is to help normalize the deceptions of the security services and to glamorize them and make them seem, you know, bold and exciting and necessary and important. And, you know, that, oh, isn't it cool that we've got the CIA? Wouldn't it be cool to work for the CIA? Like you said, they end up working together as spies. And also, I'd point out the doublethink inherent in the title, True Lies. Mm. If that's not a title that's come up with by someone working for intelligence, I don't know what it is. But not just the terrorist enemy feeds into this, but like you say, the whole personal storyline, even the daughter, even Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis's daughter in this, she starts out the movie as a bit of a, you know, rogue teenager. She mm-hmm. nips some money from his work colleague. She's a bit of a tearaway kleptomaniac adolescent, but it's not that bad, really, in the grand scheme of things, but okay. By the end of the film, of course, she steals the key for the nuclear missile. So her, you know, her habit of stealing things, oh, that's now a really good thing, because now she's stopped this terrorist from blowing up this nuclear bomb. So even in that miniature story arc, you see the same basic morality, I think. Mm. But just to pick up, again, for those of you who don't know about Ahmed Shah Massoud, this is a guy who, in the 1980s, he was fighting the Soviets. But then after the Afghan War, he starts fighting against the CIA's favorite terrorist, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He then fights against the Taliban for a while. So by the time 9/11 happens, or shortly before 9/11 happens, he's the leader of the Northern Alliance fighting the Taliban. So he's sort of... he's a very interesting one as to quite where his allegiances lay. And he was assassinated 2 days before 9/11 in a suicide bombing where someone used a bomb inside a video camera. They turn up pretending to interview him and blow them all up. But aside from that, maybe a little bit of predictive programming in True Lies, there is also the symbolic thing. this is what it really interests me, the notion of a camera as a weapon, like a film as a weapon. You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
That there is a certain three-dimensionality to this symbolism, that in a film that I think it's fair to say is a weaponized film, they've got someone using a camera as a weapon, almost admitting what it is that they're doing. So that's a little something that, you know, for people to ponder, maybe. The only other meme I particularly wanted to draw people's attention to was the nukes that these terrorists have got are inevitably ex-Soviet nukes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there must be millions of those things just around on the black market, right? You can just go and buy it in some market in Islamabad or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this turns up time and time again, and I don't think that this has ever actually happened in reality, has it? Has anyone actually found any of these ex-Soviet nukes just floating around the place?
Yeah, I know. Well, they make it seem like in the movie, like, you just go down to the corner store in Kazakhstan, and you could just pick up a couple, you know, nukes just lying around. Yeah, I don't think this is... ever happened. And I think, again, that also that the idea that these nukes are all over Central Asia in the, like, former Soviet Union is just so ridiculous. And that even if they are, I mean, these things are guarded, you know, that it's not that easy to get any of this. And we've talked about this before, the whole, like, suitcase nuke and all of that kind of stuff that comes up over and over again as a meme. And it's just so weird and stupid, because it's just the idea of it happening is so far-fetched, but of course the idea of, like, nuclear terrorism is just, you know, that scares the shit out of anybody. I forget what that movie, there's a movie you've referenced several times by HBO about some sort of dirty bomb going off, and, you know, it's everywhere. So yeah, that is a bit interesting. And also, yeah, that they're able to get a whole bunch of them.
yeah, it's not just one. They've got
right, like, yeah,
four,
yeah, yeah,
price of three or something. Yeah,
right. And again, then you also get the art dealer who helps them, and she kind of, you know, plays the role of the sort of international, you know, sort of, you're not really sure what her nationality is, but, you know, she sort of fits in the role of the kind of German or Eastern European, you know, international terrorists that you see in lots of other movies, you know, Bond movies and things like that. And she's the one who helps them acquire the nukes and is able to ship them into America disguised in these ancient Persian statues. So that's interesting also, I thought. You know, you've always got to have that other, you know, that the connecting thing between the terrorists and the nukes. And again, she's also, you know, it's a person who's of some sort of, you know, she looks Asian or something. But again, you gotta, you know, it's not a white guy who's helping them.
Yeah, sure. It's got to be someone who fits into that category of the fixer, if you like.
Yeah.
Because once again, going back to Real Bad Arabs, these terrorists are pretty incompetent.
Yeah, that was the other thing.
Who somehow managed to get hold of four nuclear weapons. You are kind of wondering, how on earth have this bunch of people managed that?
Yeah.
So, of course, they have to have that helping hand. Otherwise, the narrative doesn't make any sense. But
yeah.
This is one of those recurring themes that, you know, Arabs can't do anything. Arabs are useless and stupid. So I think there is a very much an element of that. And that's why you have that the additional character. But it is, as we discussed in our Wrong is Right episode that we did on that film, there's a lot that's quite similar between that film and this one, I think it's fair to say. But to lay it out for people, this film, more than most, has a lot of evidence of state sponsorship and state connections, I think it's fair to say. James Cameron has made several films with the Department of Defense or different branches of Department of Defense. And I think at the time he was making this, he was actually married to Catherine Bigelow.
Yes, he was.
Who, of course, made Zero Dark Thirty, and as you were discussing in your latest episode of Borkin's Policy Radio, she's now, what, making this Bo Bergdahl movie? Is that confirmed that she's making it?
Yeah. Her and Mark Boll, who wrote The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, they are preparing to make some sort of propaganda film about Bo Bergdahl. And I was just recently tweeting about that with Mark Mondelik, who writes for Boiling Frogs Post, and he was saying, it's so funny, you know, she's got this movie coming out, so maybe Michelle Obama will give her the Oscar this year. And he pointed out that, you know, it might be up against the Glenn Greenwald movie.
Yes, it might.
which is another just, you know, terrifying parallel between Zero Dark Thirty and Argo.
No, you're right. And that would not be a massive surprise, would it, if that is, in fact, what ends up happening, is those two films are facing it off for a Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was looking down the list on IMDb, a few other things jumped out at me. One was that the film had a script supervisor called Sharon Reynolds, and I'd never heard of this woman before, but I was just sort of wondering, you know, what does a script supervisor do? Supervising it on behalf of whom? You know what I mean? And looking down the other films she's been involved with, there's a couple on the DOD film list, A Time to Kill and Battleship, which... Yeah, well, but also, interestingly enough, The Social Network. She was also the script supervisor on The Social Network, which is increasingly looking like, again, some sort of state-sponsored project. It's not quite clear yet how they managed to do what they did with that film and quite who it was that was involved, but I'm becoming very much coming around to the view that that whole thing was sort of like a CIA project.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we also have well-known DOD film industry liaison Phil Strub. He was on this film. And the Marine Corps' Director of Public Affairs, a guy called John Shotwell. And most interestingly of all, they got virtually the whole of a Marine Attack Squadron, Squadron 223, which is like the Harrier jump jet unit for the Marine Corps. And they had like 2 dozen pilots were seconded to James Cameron and the rest of them for use in this film, alongside a couple of Harrier jump jets as well. So this really is a film that I think everywhere you look, these people have some kind of DOD connection. So certainly this is an example of one of those films where we have to say at least some of the stuff in this film in terms of predictive programming or in terms of stereotyping that was useful to them or whatever else we might pick out as being likely propagandistic tools, at least some of that has to be premeditated and has to be completely deliberate.
Yeah.
I can only assume you agree with that assessment.
Oh, in the little the making of featurette that you sent me the link to, the Marine sort of advisor who's there, Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Brokert, I think is his name, how you pronounce it. He's, you know, someone in the thing is quoted as saying that he championed this film as one that the Marines should support. So, again, you know, the Marine Corps should support a film where, you know, Arabs are idiots who want to blow up America, you know, and they slap women around and you know, murdering them indiscriminately is totally good. And he's even quoted in the featurette as saying that this movie will do more for the Marine Corps aviation than Top Gun did for the Navy or the Air Force. So it's been, you know, is that the point of this? Is a recruiting tool to, you know, to make this look, you know, like a cool thing to do? And it's funny in that little featurette, all of these actors just, you know, it sounds like they're reading a script once they start talking about the military and how, you know, wonderful they all were and how we wouldn't be able to make the movie without them. It's just like they have like no personality at all when they start talking about that. And it seems very scripted. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, the producers of the film were like, listen, you really got to push this, how wonderful the military is. And just to go back to the whole, you know, Oscars and films, if you can believe it, Jamie Lee Curtis actually won a Golden Globe for this movie.
Really?
So, yes, yeah. Which is just, I mean, who did they pay off to get that? I mean, it's not that she's bad, you know, or that her, you know, she's
No, in the stripper scene, I think she's great. Yeah,
yeah, no, and, you know, she's funny in the movie and she's likable. But, I mean, a Golden Globe for this, it's just, I mean, if you don't think there's a, you know, some connection between Hollywood and the military, I mean, look no further than that.
Yeah, you're right. And it is curious when we look at these films that have an enormous amount of state cooperation. They do seem to they punch above their weight in the awards scene, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
They do seem to get things that you just think, surely there must have been a better performance or a better film or a better script or a better whatever than that. Not that this is a badly made film. It's just not an exceptional film in any way.
No.
I think it's fair to say. But coming full circle and kind of back to where we started, there are two, I think, principal Arab characters that are worthy of note in this film. The first being the terrorist leader, and the second being one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's sidekicks. Mm. So let's take them in order. the terrorist leader is he's a complete stereotype, right? Like he's gone through every film that portrays Arabs and gone, right, I'll take that there and that from there and that from there.
Yeah.
And just throw them all into the one performance. And they seem very, very happy with him. He is portrayed by Art Malik, unsurprisingly, a British actor playing the bad guy. Mm-hmm. How original. Mm-hmm. But this guy's got a couple of interesting performances or two or three or four in his locker and in his career that I think you wanted to draw some attention to this, that this guy seems to be somewhat sculpted into the Arab terrorist role.
Yeah, definitely. Well, all of these, you know, for the most part in these Hollywood movies, the actors portraying Arabs are never Arab. They're either, in the case of Art Malik, he's Pakistani. So they're either Pakistani or they're many times Iranian, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at the guy who played Abu Nazir in Homeland, who's also in 24, Sleeper Cell, and The Path to 9/11, which is like a big, horrible ABC movie. But he's Iranian. Or many times they're Israeli as well. And that Oded Fehr is a famous actor who's in The Mummy. It was also in Sleeper Cell. And he's, you know, he's Israeli. Or sometimes they pick people, again, British, David Suchet, who I don't know if your listeners would know, he plays Poirot.
I think people will be familiar with, well, I hope they will.
Yeah, no, and he is a great actor, but he is not Arab. He just can kind of pass as looking Arab. And it's interesting, in Real Bad Arabs, he's picked out as one of the positive portrayals of Arabs in the movie A Perfect Murder, but he's also a pretty horrible character in Executive Decision and Iron Eagle, which are also two movies that are mentioned in Real Bad Arabs. So that is interesting. But yeah, Art Malik also was in this movie called Path to Paradise, where he plays Ramzi Youssef, and I think that was also an HBO movie, and that was, I believe, talking just about the WTC bombing. And I think you said you've seen this, right, Tom?
Yeah, I watched it recently, partly because I was looking up this actor, because like you, I sort of, you know, you just sort of, you click on his name and you think, well, what else has this guy been in, just out of interest? And sometimes you find some stuff and sometimes you don't. But then I saw this, Path to Paradise, and I thought, I've never watched this film. Why have I not, you know, why have I never seen this before, given that I've spent quite a long time on the World Trade Center bombing? And to be fair, it's not a bad kind of made-for-TV movie. It's quite well-acted and quite well-scripted and not particularly inaccurate. It softballs the CIA question, but what are you going to do? But it does portray the FBI thing, the whole thing with Imad Salem, this FBI informant who got pulled out of the group about 6 months before the bombing. It does portray that in a very suspicious light, and not just as a sort of complete FBI bungle, but like there was something else going on there, like someone like the CIA perhaps had lent in and said, you need to get rid of this guy. So it's really not a bad film at all, and Art Malik is pretty good as Ramzi Youssef and looks quite a lot like Ramzi Youssef, to be fair. So it's not at all... I wouldn't really criticize it that much. Another one that Art Malik played, and I imagine you picked up on this is also, he was an Afghan Mujahideen commander in The Living Daylights, one of the James Bond films, which was, again, assisted by the Department of Defense. So this is a guy who seems to be making a living mostly playing terrorists. And
yeah, that's what's interesting.
And it even said on Wikipedia, did you notice this? That it said he'd actually he took the job in True Lies, playing this complete racist stereotype of a terrorist, because he'd been out of work for about a year and he was being pursued by the Inland Revenue. So it seems like the guy didn't have an awful lot of choice, is that someone came knocking and said, do you want to play this Arab terrorist? We'll pay you quite a lot of money for it. He had to say yes. And maybe that's what it's like for a lot of Arab actors, or people who could pass for Arab actors, if you like. Do you think so?
I saw a slightly longer making of True Lies, and there's a part with Art Malik where he's talking about how this isn't a negative portrayal of Arabs, and that, you know, he's just misunderstood, and he's sort of joking about it, but you're also kind of like, it's not really that funny at all, Art.
No, I saw that, and I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, right, you know, I mean, it's just kind of... and it's that flippant nature, which I think is very apparent in all of these Hollywood movies, where, you know, they're kind of just like, well, you know, get over it. You know, if you can't take a joke, well, then, you know, whatever. Of course, though, if you, you know, pick out the certain minorities that you're not allowed to joke about, then it's suddenly not funny anymore.
Yeah, yeah, and suddenly you get hammered for not being politically correct. It's strange how selective and how subjective that whole thing really is.
Mm.
Rather than having either some kind of standard or accepting that perhaps there isn't a universal standard for these kinds of things and we needed to sort of approach it in a different way. But anyway, the other interesting Arab character in True Lies, very, very interesting, yes, shall we say, Arab character, is of course one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's sidekicks. He's a good guy, right? He's a spy. Right. He's working with
the
CIA.
He's the only good Arab.
Yeah, yeah, he's the good Arab. But he, again, fits into the sexually obsessed Arab stereotype. Remember, there's that bit at the start of the film where he's hacking into some computer files.
Yes.
And he starts getting all carried away, like a 12-year-old boy talking mm-hmm. about a grope a girl. And it really is utterly childish and stupid. It's quite well delivered and quite funny, don't get me wrong. But it is, once again, it's like you can't even have a good Arab without throwing in a little bit of that negative stereotype. It seems like you just can't do that in Hollywood. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And when you get into Grant Heslov, the actor, it's just even more bizarre. But yeah, I was even that. I remember after watching Real Bad Arabs and then rewatching True Lies, I made just a little note of that, you know, even the only good Arab is an Arab that works for the CIA. But even that guy can't, you know, he still sort of fits into this very one-dimensional view where, yeah, he's constantly talking about sex. He's, you know, he's always jealous of Arnold Schwarzenegger because he gets to, you know, sleep with all these, you know, crazy women and tango dancing with the arms dealer in the beginning. So that is interesting. But I think Grant Heslov's personal life is even more interesting.
Well, yeah, but I mean, just before we get into that, the thing that I found particularly strange about that character is, again, it seemed somewhat bolted on. They didn't really need him there. He's only there for the first 15 minutes of the movie, and then the last 15 minutes of the movie completely disappears in the in-between period. We don't hear from him at all.
Yes.
And it does seem like that was just something they felt the need to add in at the last minute, and they picked a guy, Grant Heslov, who up until that point hadn't had a very big career, I think it's fair to say. This is very much one of those sort of the steps that launched him to stardom, if you like. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's get into him, because he's been in some and been involved in some very interesting movies, has he not?
Yes. He's one of these guys who, like so many of these actors, is always you've seen him like 100 times in all sorts of different movies, and he generally speaking plays these kind of Middle Eastern looking characters, and he can kind of always pass for that. And you know, if his name is Ahmed in a movie, you just kind of, oh yeah, he's that Arab guy who's kind of funny and, you know, obsessed with sex or whatever.
In this film he's called Faisal. That's all.
Yeah, right, exactly.
He doesn't even have a full name.
Yeah, no,
just Arab number three or whatever.
Right. but yeah, he is a real interesting character, and he directed The Men Who Stare at Goats, which is a interesting sort of weird movie about the 1st Earth Battalion, which was this weird New Age military unit that used psychic warfare. So that's weird. But I think more importantly, he's also the producer behind Argo, which we mentioned before, and is like really good friends with Ben Affleck. So
Ben Affleck and George Clooney, yeah.
Yes, and George Clooney, yeah, exactly. And I think Grant Heslov also helped produce Good Night and Good Luck, which is about Richard Murrow, the broadcaster, and that movie was, you know, just seen as just the greatest thing ever, and that movie just sort of glosses over the fact that, you know, Murrow didn't really speak up about communism until, you know, it was sort of safe to do so. So that's interesting. And again, also another movie about television and media and how that influences people. So that's, you know, that's really interesting as well. But I think the, you know, producing Argo is probably the most interesting thing we could pick apart.
Yeah, and if all of that wasn't enough, he also had a very small role in Enemy of the State. Believe it or not. Well, of course, you would believe it. And it's particularly interesting. He is, of course, the one who assassinates someone with the gun hidden in the camera at the end of the film. He is the assassin of Ahmad Shah Massoud. if you like. And so to have him then end up making films about CIA covert operations, and in the case of The Men Who Stare at Goats, a DOD black op of some sort, or black project anyway, with all these psychic soldiers. And The Men Who Stare at Goats is actually quite a good example. We'll get into Argo in a sec, but I found that film weird and disturbing more than anything else, because it, again, it just seemed to glamorize all of this.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to, and of course that film stars George Clooney. Turns up everywhere, doesn't he?
He is a bad penny.
But actually quite a good actor, sadly. But that whole film, I mean, it's based on the John Ronson book, and John Ronson is very much one of these people who, he just writes these sort of effete, cowardly, boring versions of very interesting stories.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't all that surprising to see that the film adaptation was very, very similar in tone. It completely pulls all of its punches. There's nothing in there that isn't designed to promote all of this and actually make it seem, again, quite exciting and quite cool and quite funky. And, you know, like, this is the sort of thing we can get on board with.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, yeah, to see him then end up winning the Oscar and going and getting the Oscar with George Clooney and Ben Affleck for the best picture for Argo, no surprise at all. And yeah, Argo would be another example of this sort of movie, would it not? It's absolutely chock full of shouty Arabs. That's all Arabs do in the movie, is shout a lot, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, there's no... The whole movie, there's no context as to why the Iranians are doing this. You know, they're just always... They're just angry. They just hate America. You know, right, there's nothing about the Shah. There's nothing about the original CIA coup to, you know, murder the democratically elected president of Iran. That is just glossed over. And it's just the whole concept of the movie, of course, is just like, you know, the CIA Hollywood people's wet dream about this, you know, this idea about the CIA going to Hollywood and Hollywood helping, and just the whole, you know, Ben Affleck playing a CIA guy who's pretending to be, you know, a director of a film, and he's an actor, and you get into all of these weird sort of layers, and you sort of wonder, who the hell is Ben Affleck? You know, like, what is he really? You know, where did he come from? And how did someone who really, let's be honest, is not talented at all, get to be so, you know, how, like, from Good Will Hunting, where, not my favorite movie at all, but Matt Damon is not bad in that movie, and Matt Damon can kind of act. Now, how Ben Affleck, you know, got an Academy Award in that for writing, I don't believe that he wrote any of that. But again, that was this movie that kind of catapulted him to stardom. And, you know, now he's like one of the highest paid actors, and now he directs, you know, that's his new thing. You know, not to get too kind of into that, but if you look at his Oscar speech, it is so weird and bizarre, and you know, a lot of people were sort of joking and about just that he is some sort of MK Ultra program person who had a breakdown during that Oscar speech. But he really is strange, and you just kind of wonder, who the hell is this guy, and what, you know, what is his motive behind making these movies? Does he even have one, you know, or is he just sort of, he was put in place by someone, you know, way above him, and now he just kind of, you know, his new role is to just, you know, listen, Ben, you're going to make this movie now, and you're going to get the Oscar for it, and you're going to get, you know, millions of more dollars, and you have the pretty wife and a new house, and, you know, you get to hang out with George Clooney. So very, very odd. And also, just to mention, Grant Heslov is not Arab.
Well, and of course, nor are Iranians, but that didn't stop, stop Argo from portraying them as Arabs.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most stunning things about it. That's one of the things I just could not wrap my head around in that movie, was that every single scene with Iranians in, they were very, very, very Arab looking.
Mm.
And I mean, I've never been to Iran, but I've seen enough, you know, television from Iran to see the predominance of people there don't look like that, let alone behave like that all the time. So, yeah. And I mean, not to labor the point too much, but if you read the CIA's own internal history of the whole Argo operation, the real operation, or at least the original operation, rather than the one making a film about it, is that a lot of these sequences never actually happened. A lot of these scenes that are, you know, particularly full of shouty Arabs weren't never actually took place. They were something that was added in at the filmmaking stage. So there was clearly that undercurrent going on there, and it's very, very confusing, because it's not like the CIA are unaware of what the ethnic makeup of Iran is. And as a CIA-sponsored movie, they must have known they were just blatantly lying to people with this film. So, yeah, and Ben Affleck, he is an odd one. It is strange to see how someone with such a limited acting range and to be honest, just a sort of limited talent all around. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, I mean, some of these people, you think they've actually got some real entertainment skill. I can see how they, you know, made it in Hollywood without this kind of help. But Affleck very much strikes me as one who, yeah, if it wasn't for people helping him along, and if it wasn't for getting into bed with the CIA and the DOD, he'd be nowhere. He'd be some, you know, D-lister. No one would care.
Right. Well, he was, too, for a little while. I mean, you know, people forget that he was married to Jennifer Lopez. and, you know, that whole sort of segment of his life is just never looked at anymore. But, you know, he was sort of a bit of a loser during that time. And he made that awful piece of shit with her that just tanked. And it, you know, it seemed like his career was going to kind of tank. And then suddenly, you know, for whatever reason, he started making the right movies. And then next thing you know, he's winning another Academy Award. So really just insane. And you do have to wonder, I mean, you know, who's behind him?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I presume the same forces that were behind Charlie Wilson's War and a whole bunch of other films that, you know, we've seen recently, this total glorification of the CIA black op. It's funny, 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, they wouldn't have even admitted that they did these things. Now they're out there promoting them through Hollywood. You know, something really has changed in our lifetimes, in you know, the period that we've been alive, with regards to black ops and the whole military intelligence complex as such. But we've been at this for a while, and we do need to wrap this up. But before we do, and even though this does play into the negative Arab stereotyping a bit, I can't help but say, did you notice the Four Lions moments in True Lies? Because there are a few of them.
I actually didn't really pick up on them. I know you said that in our emails, but I was actually curious what you meant by that. And maybe they'll become more obvious once you mention them.
Well, there's the scene where our terrorist leader is giving one of his jihadi rants and the video camera runs out.
Oh, yeah.
There is obviously the missing key, which they actually draw attention to in Real Bad Arabs, the bit where, you know, he's pointing and going, with one turn of that key, we can blow up the whole city. And someone goes, what key? And the key's missing. And also the classic, absolute classic, the mishap with the shoulder-mounted rocket launcher.
That was, I did actually notice. Yeah,
where they managed to kill one of their jihadi colleagues by, you know, basically firing a rocket launcher inside a car. Sorry, inside the back of a van. But the whole film, again, this sort of thing, there is one other bit that isn't really Four Lions-y, but it's very much the same kind of, again, it just points out how insane this stereotype is, that when they're stood around inside that sort of big shed where they're burying the nuclear missile under concrete, and there's a bit where they're all firing their machine guns into the air, and I'm thinking, if you've got a series of nuclear weapons lying around, the last thing you do indoors is start firing weapons, isn't it? But for some reason, people will watch this and just buy into it. You know what I mean? They'll just watch that and think, oh, yeah, that would actually happen.
Right.
But before we...
Oh, and then...
Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and just sort of, you know, art imitating life or whatnot, the whole, you know, every scene from the NATO-led war in Libya had guys just firing randomly into the air constantly. You kind of have to wonder, you know, what, because, you know, most of the time people don't really do that, you know, that's, again, that's sort of a bit of this kind of Hollywood narrative of Arabs who do that constantly. And you kind of have to wonder, you know, if you're trying to fight this supposed civil war against this, you know, powerful militaristic government, maybe you shouldn't be wasting all of your ammunition, which, of course, then just begs the question, where were they getting all this ammunition that they
were
firing?
Well, I mean, you know, if NATO's just, you know, trucking it in by the box load, I suppose
plenty
just fire up into the air for no good reason, haven't you?
Right, yeah.
And maybe that's the point. Maybe that's the sort of sick joke at the heart of all this stereotyping, is that, in fact, you could explain a lot of this by NATO's sponsorship of Arab extremism.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really interesting parallel as well.
But before we wrap things up, is there anything you'd just like to add to or draw people's attention to again about either the documentary or about the film? And obviously, of course, just tell people about your site and your podcast.
Sure. Well, yeah, just I really would encourage everyone to go see the movie and maybe then watch True Lies again or watch some of the other films that Professor Shaheen points out, because they are really interesting. Just a, you know, quick little thing. You know, this stuff is really, really reaching like a new level. And I was recently just talking about this on my show, but with the whole Bo Bergdahl thing and Homeland, as we've discussed before, Tom, it's reaching like a new stage where just the most ridiculous kind of storylines are being fed to us through popular culture and then mysteriously happening in real life. And there's no connection between them, but we're being led into a really scary path. And not only the mainstream public, but the so-called alternative community is also being manipulated into this. And I don't really share Professor Shaheen's optimism about a positive portrayal of Arabs happening anytime soon. I think the whole, you know, Arabs and Muslims in general, the negative portrayal of them is different than the negative portrayal, say, of blacks on films used to be, or Jews, or Mexicans, or you know, pick a minority. Arabs are very different, and you know, until we stop controlling the entire Middle East, I don't think Arabs or Muslims, generally speaking, are going to change very much in popular culture, in movies and in films. And I think instead it shows like Homeland that are, you know, that are a little bit more sort of subtle in how they portray them. And, you know, you can kind of see Homeland as, you know, introducing certain elements that are sort of critical of the war on terror, but ultimately the whole show is just sponsored by the people that brought you the war on terror, and can lead you to think things such as the fact that Bo Bergdahl is a secret jihadi double agent who infiltrated the Haqqani network or something like that. But you know, yeah, my website, though, if you're interested in that, is porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. And I've got lots of podcasts up there. And if you enjoyed this conversation, then definitely go check it out. And you can follow me on Twitter at Porkins Policy, and you can also subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138Porkins. And thank you so much, Tom, for having me on again.
Oh, well, you're welcome, Pierce. I think we've had a really good chat about all of this. And just to pick up on that last point, your recent episode about the whole Bo Bergdahl thing, really, I thought it was an excellent piece, not just because you'd clearly investigated this thoroughly, but because, like we were talking about in our emails, you really tried to analyze this for what it potentially could be, rather than simply go, well, we've got this sort of and that, and, you know, make a few points here and there and say what, you know, what we can establish from the media coverage. But to take a step back and say, what if they're trying to do something quite sneaky with all of this? And I have a feeling they are, partly just because the whole thing was so well, the whole dialogue about Bergdahl was so well predicted in Homeland. And Homeland is such a kind of deeply weaponized show, a very intelligently crafted piece of propaganda, that I just felt, yeah, this thing has the ring more about, it's more about being a psyop than it is about being, you know, about who Bo Bergdahl really is. Right. In some ways, that doesn't really matter. What matters now is what people think he is. And so, yeah, I do recommend people go watch it on YouTube, or go listen to it, go download it, because it really was a good episode and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And just to make one last point, you could never see, I wouldn't have thought, an Arab actor playing a character as complex as Brody in Homeland. Would you agree?
No, never. Yeah, no, that's a great point too. Yeah.
And so on that, let's wrap things up. P.S., thanks a lot. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, absolutely, Tom. Thank you.
So there he goes. That was Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Radio, and that's about it for this show. My apologies for not having a new episode out sooner, but I have been experiencing technical difficulties recently, and I hope and expect there will be more episodes coming soon. But until then, you've been listening to Clandestine. I am Tom Secker of SpyCulture.com, Humanity.net, and InvestigatingTheTerror.com. So check into those sites for more of my work, and thank you for listening, and take care.